Welcome to episode 31 of Girls on Pop. I am your co-host, Marina Antunes, joined today by fellow co-host.
I am Ashley Lynch.
Before we get any deeper into this, Ashley, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Ashley Lynch.
And ditto on the Twitters at The Marina. Let's jump right into some movies, shall we? Or do you have anything else you'd like to talk about before we talk about movies?
No, I don't think I have any big news. I think the last thing I just saw before I hopped on here is it got announced that in the Sixth Scream movie, they're going to be moving it to New York City. And apparently some fans are not having it. They're really upset about that. Must take place in small town Worldsboro, others not Scream. It's like, whatever, do something fresh with the series.
They're making another Scream movie? That's my
new Well, yeah, answer. Because the Scream 5 made like a ton of money.
Good for them. I thought it was okay, but you know.
I liked it, and I like the Radio Silence guys. I think they made a fun movie for a franchise that I don't really have a lot of personal attachment to.
Yeah, same with me. I could care less about the Scream series, but I thought the movie was fine. It was a lot of fun. Yeah,
I'm down with more. Whatever.
Yep. All right. Well, let's talk about some movies. Let's start with talking about Top Gun, since it's never old news to talk about Top Gun.
Yeah.
Now, before we talk about Maverick, which we kind of touched on the last show, but now we've both seen it, can you talk a little bit about the fact that you had never seen Top Gun?
Yeah, I wanted to bundle these two together because for whatever reason, in all the years that I've been on this earth, and I was around for when the first Top Gun got released into theaters, everyone I knew in my friend circle had seen it and wouldn't stop talking about it. It was like huge in pop culture. And I just had no interest in the fighty jet movie. And I never went to go see it. And it just completely passed me by. And I felt like I had sort of absorbed the entirety of the movie through different sources. I'd seen Hot Shots, which is basically just a straight up retelling of Top Gun through a parody lens. And you'd seen it like basically get referenced all over the place in different forms of pop culture media. So by the time it came around to Top Gun, it's like, well, I feel like I've seen everything that I need to be seen, and I still don't care about the movie. And I wasn't even going to go see Maverick in theaters. I wasn't that interested. But then my podcast co-host was suddenly like, well, I'll go see it again if you want to see it in the theater. So we went to go see it together in IMAX. And, you know, it was any time to go see a movie in the theater with Marina is a good time. That's how I look at it.
Aww.
So I figured if I'm actually going to go see Maverick in the theater, then I should at least do it the service of seeing the original Top Gun before I go see it. Even if I feel like I've absorbed everything and I wouldn't be left behind watching Maverick just by itself, it all of a sudden felt like it had purpose. But I wanted to do it in a way that was going to be more interesting to me than just like renting a copy of Top Gun and like plopping it on my TV. So what I did was I rented the 3D version of Top Gun and watched it in my Oculus Quest because that was available in the big screen app that's on the Oculus Quest. There's a whole bunch of 3D movies you can rent, and they're all Paramount movies because apparently Paramount has sort of bought into this idea. So there's a lot of Mission Impossible and Top Gun that are part of the 3D options you can rent in the app. So I rented Top Gun in 3D and I watched it that way. I sat on my couch with my Oculus Quest on my face and I watched Top Gun in 3D. And the movie, it was fine. It didn't really do much for me. It was exactly what I expected. I suppose I enjoyed it, and I like Tony Scott as a filmmaker, so it's always nice to watch a Tony Scott movie. And this is really like the one that like broke him. It's like this huge tour de force. I think my review after finishing the movie was Tony Scott never met a sunset he didn't want to marry. I will say though that the 3D for the movie was unfortunately thoroughly unimpressive. I don't know if it's the case or if it's a problem with like when the movie was made. Like it's easier to pull a stereoscopic print off of something that's shot digitally because you're going to have cleaner components that you can essentially rotoscope out. But because of the type of cameras and the type of film stocks that they were able to, or that they were forced to use to try to capture some of this aerial photography, which is a feat in and of itself in the film because it's kind of unreal what they've captured. Because this is before the days of, like, there are no special effects in the film. You know, it's like just, it is what it is. And it's a really grainy. There's a lot of noise in those skies. I think it was probably really hard to try to create a stereoscopic version of that movie. And when you watch the 3D version, it's like the credits end and then it just freeze frames on the sunset at the end. And it comes up with a whole second set of credits of all the people who worked on the stereoscopic version. And there are more credits for this 3D stereoscopic Top Gun than there are for the original production of Top Gun. It's kind of nuts. I just wish it had resulted in a better 3D experience, but whatever. I saw it. I ticked it off. It's a perfectly fine film. And then we went to go see Top Gun Maverick. And I'll say right off the bat, I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed Top Gun. And I think that's because it adds a lot of things that I think Top Gun was lacking, which was any sense of stakes or something more important that was driving the story forward rather than just like who could be the best of the best of the best. And there is that in Top Gun Maverick, and it's essentially just telling the same story over again. But it has this added component of, we need you to train a team to do this bombing run of this, dare I say it, impossible mission. And it does that. They've basically kind of added the Mission Impossible structure to retelling the story of Top Gun. And it actually works quite well. It's really enjoyable. The characters are good. The story moves at a nice, fast clip. And by the time it gets to that final act when they're actually doing the mission, because you spend so much time with them, the entire movie is just them training for the mission, just trying to get this new team of best of best people, of pilots, to basically be able to do this insane run. And the whole last part of the movie is them doing the mission. And they've gone through it so many times that you know exactly what is happening. It's like it's been laid out so clearly. It's like, oh, I'm not confused what they're doing now. They're doing this leg of the trip, you know, and now they have to do this maneuver. Can they pull it off? Oh, they pulled it off. Okay, now for the next one. And, you know, it works really well. I think my biggest problem with Top Gun is that it is, or sorry, with Maverick specifically, is that it is very much almost a meta movie, in that so much of the movie is just about the first movie. So much so to the point where the entirety of the opening credits is just a complete recreation of the opening credits from the first film, straight up to the same text crawl that comes up to inform us about the school of Top Gun. It's like, wait, I'm at the sequel for Top Gun. I already know this. I don't need this information. And then the exact same opening sequence of dudes on a sunset lit carrier waving jets off into the sky and jets landing as Danger Zone kicks into gear. And it's like, so much of it was just like repeating nostalgia from the first film. And I don't respond well to the tugs for nostalgia in films. Maybe some people, it gets to them a little bit more. Me, it actually irritates. I'm like, show me something new. I accept that this is a sequel and we're kind of like do the same thing but bigger. I kind of get that that's sort of baked into the cake. But don't just recreate stuff from the first movie and expect me to clap like a seal. It's not going to happen. And that's the stuff that turned me off. the stuff where the movie is doing is being an original film and doing new stuff and just like telling a story, that stuff was all great, and I enjoyed that a lot. You know, even like the opening where we see like, okay, where is Tom Cruise's character now? It's like, oh, he's flying an experimental jet where they're trying to get up to Mach 10. And like, that stuff was incredible. It's like, you know, it shot really cool and genuinely exciting. So it's when it was trying to just do Top Gun, I didn't like the movie. When it was actually telling its own story, I thought it was a lot of fun.
I mean, you just have to listen back to know how I feel about it. I really, really like Top Gun Maverick, but I'm still in the camp of I like Top Gun better than the sequel, for reasons, again, discussed last time. But I think you're totally right. Maverick's works is at its best when it's doing its own thing. And it does have way more story and plot than the first movie ever did. But I think for me, I guess part of my love for the first one is that nostalgia factor. There's a lot of stuff wrapped up into that movie that I can't like walk away from. So it does hold a special part in my heart. But I did really like Maverick, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed it, because I'm always kind of like, it's so well done and it's so much fun, but is it for everybody? Probably not. So it's always a little bit of how much are you going to take away from this? How much are you going to enjoy it? And you're right. The nostalgia thing is, it's always been a pet peeve of mine. Here, they play it, I think it goes a little too far. And those are the moments that really don't work for me. And the fact that the movie's most quotable lines are literally rehashes from the first movie also don't bode particularly well. However, Maverick is a lot of fun and it looks amazing. And give me all the behind the scenes making of, because I will watch it all. All of it.
One thing that I particularly liked, and when I talked about Maverick being basically like a meta movie, there's one other part of it that I actually genuinely liked. And it was, we get to see Val Kilmer reprise his role as Iceman, who is now basically an admiral and is basically behind the scenes, has been sort of keeping Maverick's career alive because he's just like an eternal fuck up who, you know, won't stop stepping on toes and pushing boundaries. And like, the only reason this guy still has a career at all of the Navy is, you know, basically due to Iceman. And we basically just see texts from Iceman to Maverick throughout the course of the film. And that gets to a point where we get a scene with Val Kilmer. And leading up to it, I was so worried because Val Kilmer, I don't, you know, for people who may not have been keeping track, but the man actually went through having, I believe it was throat cancer. And as a result, that's why you don't see him in many movies anymore. And it's really hard for the dude to talk. And when you do hear him talk, there's like part of me that like feels bad when I hear him like struggling to get words out. And then I feel bad for feeling bad. And like, it hurts, and I don't like seeing Val like that. And I was really worried for how it was going to be having him in this movie. Like, the worst of the case is the movie The Snowman, where Val Kilmer has a role in that, and they decide to just like dub someone else's voice in there, and it's a weird sounding voice that isn't even close to Val Kilmer. It's like, what's going on? So I was worried for how Maverick was going to handle it, and it ends up being an incredibly respectful scene. Val Kilmer comes off so good. It has a lot of emotional weight to it, but more than anything, the scene felt like it was kind of like an emotional send-off for Val Kilmer's career. Is like, this is the thing that he's going to go out on, it almost feels like. I don't know if that's the case. Maybe the dude has, like, you know, more things in store for us in the future. But that was definitely the feeling I got from it. And it was in that moment, the film became about Val Kilmer's career and paying homage to that instead of just paying homage to Top Gun. And I actually genuinely liked that moment.
Yeah, I think that came off really well. And I saw an article earlier this week. I'll see if I can dig it up. Apparently, Val Kilmer can't speak at all anymore. And the voice in the film is actually AI.
Really?
Cobbled together from previous performances. So I'll dig that up. I saw an article in passing about it, so I'll have to do a little bit more research, but that's kind of what's in the back of my mind, is reading that it wasn't actually him speaking. But I'll see if I can find that article and I'll link to it.
That sounds fascinating. And I have not seen that documentary that he did.
Oh, Val.
Either looking back on his career. I still need to watch that.
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime. It's very, very good. Highly recommended. It's a good one. So that, any other thoughts on Top Gun or Top Gun Maverick now that you've seen?
I mean, not really. And more that just, I think, honestly, I was surprised that I enjoyed Maverick so much. You know, I didn't love it. Will I watch it again ever? Maybe. Maybe not. But I definitely enjoyed myself more than I did watching Top Gun.
I will definitely pick it up in 4K. I will definitely watch it again. But I have a feeling that the next time that I need to watch, that I want to watch Top Gun, I'll be watching the original.
And I think that if you're going to go see it in the theater, if you haven't seen it yet, because I guess that's the other side of the story, is Top Gun Maverick is really having a moment at the box office.
Yeah.
It is exploded into an outright phenomenon, I think, at this point. But if you haven't seen it yet and you are planning to see it and you can see it in IMAX, I would recommend IMAX. I think it is worth it.
I agree. Fully, fully agree. Let's talk about RRR. Because I haven't seen this yet, but I've seen lots of memes and lots of internet buzz about this. So tell me about this movie, which I think is on Netflix, right?
It is on Netflix now. Speaking of movies that are phenomenons, this movie, RRR, which stands for, I believe it's Rise, Roar, Revolt, is a South Asian historical action film, basically a Bollywood film, that's about the revolt against colonialist rule in pre-independent India in the 1920s. And basically it's about these two guys who are just like practically like gods in their fighting prowess and their passion, and what they're trying to achieve in different ways of you know, bringing up revolution against the British, that strike a friendship. And they're also at odds with each other because one of them is essentially just a straight up revolutionary, and the other has basically cemented himself as a like chief guard in the British police. And he's doing that specifically just so that he can get his hands on a bunch of weapons and get them back to his people to start the revolution. But this puts these two men at odds because they're essentially on different sides of the law. And they strike up a friendship together, and then they're at odds with each other, and there's fighting back and forth, and, you know, it ends up being an incredible emotional journey of these two men in the midst of basically starting a war against the British, both also being at odds with each other and in love with each other. And when they're united, it's just like, you know, it's like every sort of like bromance action buddy cop sort of thing in that way. But it is filtered through an incredible over the top Bollywood experience. And what I likened it to was like the apex of the 90s era of Hong Kong filmmaking, where you have these incredible stunt spectacular action films, but they're also stories of characters where it's like all heart on sleeve, very sincere, huge emotions ramped up to 11, and huge action set pieces that surround that, and to where the driving the driving force behind every character's, essentially their abilities, is driven by their will and their passion. And this film very much kind of fits into that. And it's also mixing it with the other things that you would typically get from a Bollywood film, where it's like, we're just going to take time out now for a dance scene. And now we are going to, like, win over the people with the power of our song and our dance. And you get that. But the film is just, it's an extravaganza. Like, there's nothing, there's no moment in this film where the film is not saying, no, I think we should pull back. I don't think we should go too big with this. Everything is constantly at this incredibly heightened level to an almost absurd degree. And I think there are some people who are probably going to, if people who aren't used to incredibly sincere, heightened emotional filmmaking like this, I think it's very easy to, like, kind of laugh at it in a kind of self-reflexive way. But I absolutely adored this movie. I thought it was amazing. The action is good. The characters are good. It is so huge and grandiose. And I saw so many things that I've never seen on film before. And it just, it was an absolute delight. And I think the only detriment, is not even really a detriment, is the movie is over 3 hours long. It is not a short trip. Like, when I was first watching it, I had to watch it in two different sessions because I was falling asleep. And I was like, nope, gotta finish it tomorrow. But I got to a point where it's like, I feel like we're coming up on the climax. How much is left? And I check, it's like, there's still another whole half a movie to go. But by the time I got, I think it pays off, because by the time I got to the end of the movie, I was genuinely in tears because I was so emotionally wrought with the film. It's like, this is a great movie. I highly recommend it. Absolutely loved it.
I didn't realize there was this much love for Triple R. I'm going to move that up on my Netflix queue.
It's also like, it's happened before, but this movie is like an international sensation as well. It is played in American theaters, you know, and it's on Netflix right now, and it's like doing very well for Netflix. You know, it's not all that often that you get films that really break out of these international markets like this and explode culturally in different countries. And RRR has had that kind of impact.
Yeah. Like I say, I remember seeing a lot of Twitter buzz about it, and I kind of, okay, well, I'll watch that, but didn't realize it was that good. All right. Adding that. I have not seen a lot of movies since we last talked. I literally watched Top Gun with you, and I watched a couple of VOD releases, one of which is The Valet, which I'm not quite sure if you saw the trailer for this. It's not the kind of movie that I think you might like. I don't know why I think that, but it's a romantic comedy, so, you know, it varies in how far it appeals. But it's directed by Richard Wong, and it stars Samara Weaving and Eugene Debrez. Weaving plays this...
Wait a minute, you think I wouldn't like a movie with Samara Weaving?
I don't know. Do you like Samara Weaving?
I love Samara
Weaving. Okay, so you may... Okay, so, okay. It feels like this very kind of like... It is a bit of a goofy... semi-romantic drama. It's,
I hear you.
So Weaving stars as this actress who has a new movie coming out that she's like very, very keen on it being successful because it kind of is going to be like the new thing in her career. Except she gets caught in this little mini scandal because she is dating a married man who leads like this multi-million dollar company. And in the tabloid photo... Eugene Debrez happens to be in the background because he is the valet at the hotel where they were having their little tryst. So her publicity manager decides to devise this plan where she is actually going to date the valet for good press because he's like just some rando until the movie comes out. And then after the movie comes out, they're going to break up. And of course, as you might imagine, what happens is they don't actually the thing that I like about this movie is it doesn't follow the typical trope that you might expect. They do develop like an actual friendship, and it is becomes a very sweet story about this woman who is, you know, basically like a Hollywood starlet and totally out of touch with reality, who meets this very down-to-earth guy who is just trying to do the best for himself and his family. And they form like a sincere friend relationship based in friendship where, you know, they can actually talk to each other about their lives and they kind of become like better human beings because they know each other. It sounds totally like ludicrous and saccharine, and it is a little bit, but it's also super charming. Debrez is very, very funny. Weaving is very, very good. And there are some really funny moments that actually had me laughing out loud. So I would say that if it looks like it might appeal to you, it is kind of a breath of fresh air. It's very breezy and a lot of fun. I really liked it. It surprised me how much I enjoyed it.
I will throw it on my list.
Interceptor.
This is, I believe a Netflix original, but it's on Netflix. And this is basically just a little action thriller from Matthew Riley. And starring Elsa Pataky, who you might remember, she had a role in a couple of the Fast and Furious movies, and like she's, you know, she's good at the action, and a lot of fun to watch. But the entire premise is basically there are a couple bases basically like out at sea that control the interceptor missiles, which are missiles that can basically intercept a nuclear launch. And there's only essentially, I don't know if this is true or not, but at least as far as the film purports, this is true. There's only actually two of them. And I think they're like different coasts or whatnot. And basically terrorists have seized and sacked one of them. And now they're, at the same time, they're going after the other one where Elsa Pataky is stationed. And she basically in this standoff state where she's locked down the control room and the terrorists are trying to get in. And it's, you know, Die Hard on a like missile tower out at sea. And basically if she fails and they get in the control room, then all of a sudden nuclear missiles are going to take out the U.S. So she is the last line of defense between everyone being destroyed. And that's basically your premise. The story, honestly, not that good. The action is fine. But it's also, the movie's got a lot of charm, too. And it's enjoyable. And it's short. And it's just like, it's a fun, dumb little action movie that I wish went harder or did more interesting things. But I also think that they also were like working with very little too. It feels like really low budget. Most of it takes place in one set. It was clearly building up to, and you see this on the poster, this one huge like stunt that she does in the film, which is more or less like her one arm's been injured, so she can't use it, and she has to essentially like swing on these like hand over hand rails, and then there's like one of them missing, so she has to like swing and do this big jump, and she does it basically one handed, where she like works up the swing and then lets go and flies forward far enough to grab it with the same hand, and it. The movie knows that this is like the big moment and it plays it like that. It's a lot of fun. She is in real life married to Chris Hemsworth, which accounts for why he is both executive producer on the film and also appears uncredited in the film as several times as basically an electronics store employee that's watching the whole thing play out live on newsfeed, and it's like cheering her on. And we honestly, for it not being a Chris Hemsworth movie, we see way too much Chris Hemsworth in this movie.
Impossible. You can never see too much
Chris Hemsworth. I know, but it's her movie. Let her have her movie. Get out of there, Chris. You know? at the same time, he's a little bit of comic relief that shows up, so whatever. But it's, I'm not going to say it's a good movie, but it was so fun and I enjoyed it. And, you know, you could, there are definitely worse dumb action movies you could spend your evening with. So I know there's my tepid endorsement of Interceptor.
I kind of feel like all my endorsements for this week are kind of very tepid. The other movie that I watched is another sort of romantic comedy. Well, it's not a comedy. Romantic drama, I guess. It's called Press Play. It actually comes out on Friday the 16th. And it stars, of all people, the man of the moment, Lewis Pullman.
Who is Bill Pullman's kid, and is in Top Gun Maverick.
Exactly, and I only, of course, knew that because you and I had this discussion after Top Gun. So I was like,
oh. He looks like his father, too.
Now that I know, yeah, for sure. It's kind of like, yeah, I can totally see the resemblance. So it stars Bill Lewis Pullman and Clara Rugard, who is in I Am Mother, the Netflix film from, I guess, last year, which I still have not seen, but I've heard good things about her. In it. So this is directed by Greg Bjorkman. It's his debut feature. It's based on a concept from Josh Boone, who made Fault in Our Stars and kind of has a track record for making sort of like teen romantic dramas, I guess. And this is very similar. It's kind of in that wheelhouse in that you have these two people that meet at a record store. They fall in love. They make a mixtape together, something happens, one of them dies, and then the other discovers that they can travel back into a moment of time where they first heard the song that's on the mixtape together at the same time. And so she has, I don't know, however many tries to go back and kind of fix it so that he doesn't die, except every time she goes back, you know, something inadvertently happens that changes the present or the future. Don't think about it too much. Because the time travel, this is what happens. if you try too much, it just breaks. And I mean, admittedly, it's not the most convoluted of the time travel stories I've seen, but it's also one that doesn't stand up to a whole lot of scrutiny. But it's kind of just an excuse to make this story interesting, I think. And honestly, I think it actually works quite well. Lewis and Clara have really great chemistry. And the movie's just very sweet and has a really great soundtrack. I mean, it is about a mixtape, so music is kind of key to the story. It's nice. I liked it. That's my endorsement. It's nice.
It's a neat premise because I think we can all identify to a degree with like, oh, you can remember when this song was important to you when it comes on. You can hear a song 30 years later and all of a sudden it takes you back to this moment in time in your life.
Yeah, and it does have some really neat things that, you know, maybe people that are younger won't think too much of it, but as somebody that grew up listening to tapes, the whole, she has to Google how to rewind a tape manually. And I'm like, seriously? This is not something that's obvious?
Do the pencil and the spoke thing and twist it back?
Yeah, which I thought was kind of amusing. And then Danny Glover has a very small role, and he's very good in it. He's just kind of like moral support. He's very charming. I enjoyed it. I mean, I can't say it's like totally groundbreaking and oh my God, it's the best romantic movie I've seen this year. But you know what? It was really sweet and I really, really did have fun watching it. So I would say it's
one. It looks cute.
Yeah. I'd say if the trailer looks appealing, it's definitely worth checking out. And Lewis Pullman is pretty great in it. So hey, two for two for me. The Domestics.
Yeah, this one's a little bit of an older film. And by older, I mean like 4 years older. It's from 2018. We don't tend to like reach back that far on this show.
No, we either do like current or really old.
Yeah. But yeah, this was a movie that was on my list that I finally got around to, which is it's a really neat kind of premise and world building that's going on where basically it's like post-apocalypse, there's been like some chemical warfare thing that's happened. Most of the people in the world are wiped out. And so you have like, you know, middle America. And the survivors have basically all banded into what I call Warriors-like kind of gangs, in that it's these really hyper-stylized gangs that have all centered around one defining trait. Like, there's a gang that calls themselves the Gamblers, and all they are is they're just fucking gambling addicts. Everything they do is all about odds making. And there's another gang of people who just wear deer heads on their head. There's a gang that calls themselves the Ghosts, and they all wear white sheets over their heads as they go around and try to rob people. And then there are also people who are known in this post-apocalyptic wasteland as the Domestics. And these are people who are still just trying to live a normal kind of suburban life post-apocalypse and not be part of, like, some kind of roving gang. And these are our main characters. We've got the two leads played by Kate Bosworth and Tyler Hoechlin, who I'm not all that familiar with.
Okay, so I'm just looking at this on my phone because I don't remember hearing about this. I'm like, holy fuck, it's Superman. He's the new Superman in Superman.
Oh, is he the new Superman?
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't watched the new Superman, so that's probably why I didn't get it.
Yeah, Superman and Lois is actually quite good on a total side tangent. Very good. It's a really great show. But sorry, back to this cast, which is very impressive.
Kate Bosworth I'm more familiar with. But anyway, so they're just this married couple, and they have decided to basically make this, where they're living is no longer safe, and so they've decided to make this pilgrimage to, I believe it's Milwaukee, where there's essentially like this suburban community that they're just going to plug into. And so they have to make the treacherous journey of loading up the car and driving through America's wasteland, more or less, in this violent Mad Max-like adventure to try to make it to Milwaukee. And along the way, they encounter all sorts of different gangs and get into all sorts of different violence. And it's a really interesting story and a really interesting world that's built, because it's a little bit over the top. And kind of abstracted. And I think that's really interesting. And I think the problem is the fact that I said it's a little bit over the top. It's a really cool premise told in the blandest way possible, and the most straightforward, matter-of-fact way possible. And I feel like if there was someone who, and it's like, it's a writer-director, Mike P. Nelson did it, and I think he probably had like a pretty good script, and he directs it just fine, but it feels like it needs more than fine. It needs flourish. And if you're gonna have this amount of kind of satirical absurdity with the post-apocalyptic wasteland, you have to also show that to us visually. And the film never really does that. And I think it was more a missed opportunity than anything. I think there's something here. I'd almost like to see another stab at it.
That's too bad, because I really do like the cast. When I was looking, I was like, oh, this sounds great, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's a neat movie, and I almost hesitate to recommend it, because I think in its final form, I don't think it's that good. It's more like about what could have been. There's so much promise here.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, I can't win them all. Let's talk about some TV. Let's start with Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey, which I haven't yet watched, but is on my list for this week.
Yeah, I watched this, mostly just because I find it both equal parts disturbing and fascinating. It's a four-part doc series that's on Netflix, which is all about a offshoot of the Mormon Church of Latter-day Saints, which was a fundamentalist sect that broke off and basically just became like a huge kind of haven for polygamy and child abuse. And as depicted in the documentary, it's honestly just a straight up cult. It was one creepy guy who wanted to marry like 40 women and have access to little girls that he could molest and groom. And that's what he did, and centered it all around religion. It's a fascinating documentary because they actually had like kind of an extreme amount of like wealth and power, but at the same time, they also knew that they weren't really accepted in modern society in any way, and so almost immediately started trying to like build essentially a compound that no one could ever get access to, that they could be segregated from. And it's generally upsetting when you think about, like, a lot of it is told from the perspective of a lot of the women who got out of it and were also part of the lawsuit against the church founder, who, you know, I guess spoilers for real life, eventually was convicted and he'll never see the light of day outside of prison again. But just how organized religion can be used to just completely subject people to completely inhuman environments that they will defend staying in. You know, it's genuinely upsetting to me. And I feel like it's important to watch stuff like this to be aware of these organizations and how they operate, if only to be able to better identify them. And it's really easy to stand at afar and just kind of like point and say, well, that's crazy. Don't do that, obviously. But I'm always fascinated by getting inside the walls and inside the heads of the people who are inside of these sorts of situations to find out what it is that was like grabbing at them, that was able to pull them into these things. And for a lot of the cases with especially with the women, is it just that they were born into it. They didn't know anything different. I will say that I heard the term sister wives casually spoken so many times over the course of the doc series that I never want to hear that term again in my entire life.
Yeah, I think these documentaries are really interesting because, like, when I saw your tweet about Sister Wives, all I could think about was that one of the networks has a show called Sister Wives, and I'm like, it's just kind of baffling how two things that are very, very similar. And then it makes me think, well, it's reality TV is not real, but the fact that these people do think it's okay to have this kind of lifestyle, and I'm not saying it's not okay, but the fact that it can so easily turn bad and it can so easily be something so terrible and awful, it's just kind of baffling to me. The whole thing just kind of creeps me out. I just don't even know how else to think about it.
I mean, one of the big kind of like warning signs for me is whenever you see something as one direction. When you see it's always a guy with five wives.
Which it generally
never,
is.
It's never a woman with five husbands. When this thing only ever goes one direction, then that's how you know it is a system for controlling and owning women. Not because of people who don't believe in traditional marriage. And that's when my hackles kind of like sit up and take notice and want to say, no, this needs to kind of be exposed for what it is.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Totally. Also, another documentary on Netflix, one that I watched, and I think it's also a four-parter, is Bad Vegan. Which is an expose on Sarma Margalis. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but she was very, very big in, I guess, I want to say like the late 90s, early 2000s. She was the founder of Pure Food, which was one of the first like fully vegan restaurants in New York City. And she kind of started the whole like clean eating, vegan as a popular thing kind of movement. And then she got hooked up with this guy who she eventually married named Anthony Strangis. And he turned out to be like this manipulating bastard who basically took her for everything she had, took her mother for like $500,000, investors for another like $3 million or something. And at the end of the day, Sarma was left holding the bag. And ended up going to jail for I don't even know how long, for embezzlement, essentially, for like $6 million. And so now she has no career, and this estranged husband of hers got out with time served because he couldn't meet bail when they eventually caught them ordering pizza, of all things. in some backwater town somewhere. And he's basically walking around and able to do this again to somebody else. I don't know. There's nothing like particularly interesting about this documentary other than the story is completely fascinating. And it's kind of sad to see a woman who is so bright and has so much going for her and was really at the top of her game in an industry that is so male dominated, because she was basically running her own restaurant and eventually opened a second location. And she was extremely popular. And, you know, she was basically taken by this dude who's like this complete loser, like complete, never had a job, never really did anything, had all of these ideas that he couldn't implement. And the fact that somebody could be so, I guess, smitten or taken by love that they would be so blind to let themselves be taken like this is just kind of, it's just mind blowing. And the fact that, you know, she talks about it very openly and she's like, yeah, you know what? Basically, I fucked up. Blinded by love. I screwed up. Don't let this happen to you. And and the conversations that she recorded between herself and him is like, how do you not see all of the red flags? You know, they say hindsight's 20/20. Yeah, it's a really, I wouldn't say entertaining, but it's a really interesting docuseries for sure. I really enjoyed it.
How many episodes is it?
I think it's 4 or 5 at most. It's quite short as well. So that's Bad Vegan. Let's talk about something we've both watched. Let's start with Stranger Things, because it is, still fairly fresh. I think it only came out a couple of weeks ago. And I'm kind of curious, before we talk about the new season, what have you thought of Stranger Things up until this point?
Well, I haven't seen any of the new season yet, so this is going to be just you.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, you had the boys on your list. Okay, that's what I've been seeing. Okay, so sorry.
I've been on the fence, because for Stranger Things, I kind of, at the end of season 2, I felt like I was kind of done with the show and I didn't bother with season 3. And now the hype has started up for season 4 and people are digging. I'm like, should I jump back in? And I'm like, so on the fence. At the same time, I have so many other things to watch. So I don't know. Maybe I'll dive back into it again. Remains to be seen.
Okay, so I'll be vague. For whatever reason, I thought I saw it on your list, so I apologize. But I was not a fan of seasons 2 and 3 of Stranger Things, to the point where if you asked me what happened in either of those seasons, I probably couldn't tell you. Not even like in wide brush strokes could I tell you what the plot was for either of those seasons, because I simply don't remember. That is how invested I was in them. We were watching them sort of reluctantly because it was a thing to watch. And I know Dan enjoys it quite a lot more than I do. But season 3, I thought, was like a complete letdown, to the point where like I really didn't enjoy any of it except for perhaps the last 2 episodes. So I wasn't quite sure what to make of season 4. We watched it because it kind of came out at a time when there was really nothing else to watch and we're always looking for something to watch together. And I have to tell you, season 4 is probably my favorite season of all of Stranger Things, including season 1.
Really?
It's so good. I think because season 1 kind of introduced the entire concept, this maybe is the second best season so far, because there's still part 2, they could still royally fuck it up. But part 1 of season 4 is excellent. And honestly, considering how little I remember of seasons 2 and 3, I would say you're probably okay to skip seasons 2 and 3, or at least season 3, and jump right into season 4. If you're a completionist like me...
I think if I dive into this, I doubt I'm going to go back and watch season 3.
This is it. Like, the completionists might want to go back, but honestly, I don't think you need to.
But yeah, if it's that good, maybe I'll give it a shot.
It's... we really enjoyed it. There are parts of it that are still... I mean, the whole thing is fucking ridiculous. And there are parts of it that's still a little bit eye-rolling, but... generally speaking, the overall feel for this season is so much better. It is so good. And Jamie Campbell Bauer, God bless him. I didn't think he was a good actor because Twilight, pretty much the only thing I've seen him in. Not great, but he is excellent as Vecna. Absolutely excellent. So I was really excited to see him in a role where he was actually like acting and being really great. So... yeah, season 4 of Stranger Things. Thumbs up from me. I am back on the bandwagon. Give me the rest of the season.
All right, I'll have to check it out.
Okay, now let's talk about something we've both seen. The Boys. The new season of The Boys.
Yeah, there's four episodes of the new season that are currently out. They dropped, like, I was kind of surprised at this, they dropped, like, 3 episodes in one day.
Yeah, which... I know,
boded like well. 1/3 of the season, just like all at once.
Yes, I was so excited. We watched them, 2 of them in a row, and then, you know.
But yeah, this is a show that I really like. I don't know. I almost feel like The Boys needs defending because it is crass. It is gory. It is violent. It is rude. Offensive in a lot of ways, and it very kind of, I guess, it's always playing on that line of being edgelord material. And like, I went back and read the original comic, and it very much is an edgelord comic. I stopped reading the comic because I did not like it very much. I think it goes too far.
And wow.
It's like second page is just like outright rape scenes. And, you know, it's just like there was no line that comic was not willing to cross. And it was an ugly comic. And that's the danger that the show is always in. And I think they're always able to like walk up to that line and not cross it. Is that the show never really becomes a truly ugly show to the point where you feel like you're being punished for watching it. But it does want to walk up to that line. And the other thing I think I love about it is just the core conceit. It's the idea that if superheroes were real, if they existed in this world, if you had someone who had the power of Superman in this world, they would be a fucking monster, because that's what happens when you give someone that much power. And the way the character of Homelander is played by Anthony Starr really makes me question Anthony Starr as a person, because he is so good at playing this role, and he is so genuinely terrifying in every scene that he is in, because you never know, is this the moment that he's just going to turn violent because there is no one that can issue any consequences for his actions, and so he can do whatever the fuck he wants, and everyone in the world is just at the mercy of hoping today he's in a good mood. And he plays it so perfectly that I have a hard time not believing that Anthony Starr isn't himself a psychopath. Everything I've seen says that he is a genuinely lovely human being. And I loved him in the show Banshee, too. He's great in that show, too. But he is genuinely terrifying in this show. And it is so good. And I think this season, I think they're, like, at the top of their game. I think the show it never been this good. Like, right out of the gate, the kind of satire that they have for all things, like, right off the bat, they're cracking jokes about this Snyder cult having saying that their Dawn of the Seven movie was only saved by the fans with the hashtags. They were going to scrap the whole thing after the whole Stormfront Nazi thing, but fans brought it back. They were okay with the Nazi. Hashtag save the Seven. And that's the type of the satirical level that the show is constantly operating on in a take no prisoners kind of way constantly makes me cackle. And I love it. I love the show.
I'm with you. And I think what I really appreciated, and you totally nailed it, is this idea that they walk up to this line of, are they actually going to go there? And sometimes you think, no, they're not going to do that. And they don't. And other times you say, oh, no, they're not going to do that. And then they do it. And you're like, oh, my God, they went there. And then there is shit that you just cannot unsee.
Yes.
Ever. And you're like, why?
The first episode I will never unsee for the rest of my life.
It's so bad. And you know, then the thing I was thinking about was, I could totally see this as a conversation that like a bunch of comic book nerds might have around the table. Like if you were Microman and you were tiny and you could do like anything, what kind of shit would you get yourself into? And it's like, you're just like spitballing ideas and then somebody's like, fuck, that would be a really great episode for this TV show.
But then this show takes like those sort of like what if conversations, but they set the premise in, okay, superheroes in real life, what would they be like? They'd be deprived motherfuckers. It's like, yes, if you were Ant-Man, of course you're going to do the most depraved fucking sex shit with your power that you could possibly do. And it also gets like I remember it became a thing with the Avengers, the whole Thanos saga was out. It also became a popular meme. It's like, well, Ant-Man should just like fly up Thanos's butt and then grow big and explode him from the inside out and everyone's saved. And this became this popular like headcanon that everyone on the internet had. And where does this show immediately go to in season 3? You've got basically your Ant-Man surrogate and he tries to fly up someone's but to kill them.
The whole thing is just insanity. I like, the show is just so over the top, but it's so well done. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I love absolutely. It. And in the most recent episode 4, it opens up with this archive footage from the 70s of the show Solid Gold, where one of the characters, Soldier Boy, appears on and starts doing like this bad 70s rap that makes absolutely no sense at all. It was just, it was some of the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life.
Oh yeah, no, it's so good. It's so good. Not for everybody, but so good.
Yes, this is like hard R-rated material. It's a show I wish I could watch with my daughter, but I don't think I can watch it. Like she, at this point, she's old enough, I think. But I don't think I could watch this in the same room as her and not feel like a horrible parent.
Oh, man. How about, okay, switching gears completely. Miss Marvel, which I haven't seen yet.
Yes. So there's one episode of Miss Marvel that's out currently. This is, of course, the new Disney Plus Marvel series based on the character. And I don't know, depending on where you're at, whether or not you're feeling fatigue for these types of shows or not, and it's like totally acceptable if you are. It's like, I was sort of tepidly looking forward to this. I like the character. It's like, cool, we're going to do this. At the same time, there's that feeling of like, here we go again. But I was absolutely delighted by the first episode of this show. It has so much energy and is told in such a fun and invigorating way that usually these shows don't get the treatment for. And they kind of get there by virtue of the fact that they're telling it as a story about basically a young teenager. And through that virtue, they're able to, they're adopting an incredibly kind of playful and energetic tone where it's like, there's constantly like animation that's laced throughout because we're getting that sort of like, almost like Into the Spider-Verse sort of like, you know, active environment where the character's imagination is basically infecting the entire world around them for what they see sort of thing. And we end up getting like an almost aggressively energetic world that she's living in because we're seeing it entirely through her eyes. And the it's a really fun telling of it, and I'm really enjoying it. It's like, it helps that I like the character too, but it's I'm really digging it. I'm excited to see where it goes.
And finally, because I had no idea they'd actually made this, and now I'm looking at it, I'm like, how did I have no idea they made this?
Yes.
Irma Vep? Like, yes. Seriously? They made a TV series?
Yes.
I didn't even know?
There's only one episode out of this currently. As soon as I saw this, I was just like, holy crap, they're remaking Irma Vep as a series?
Is it on HBO?
It is on HBO Max. This is, if you're not familiar with Irma Vep, it is a movie from, oh God, I want to say early 90s?
Yeah, I think so.
But it is a French film where, very much like a cinema verite film, where Hong Kong actress Maggie Cheung is flown to France to make a movie that is a kind of modern artistic retelling of an old silent era film called The Vampires. And she is playing a character called Irma Vep. And the entirety of the movie is basically following around Maggie Cheung, and she is essentially like a stranger in a strange land, this Hong Kong actress who is now in France and doesn't particularly know what she's doing on this movie, just that it's something interesting that she wants to do, and also just trying to get around in this country and this city that she's not familiar with. And we just basically hang out with her as she's, you know, making this movie and getting into weird adventures. And it's a neat film. And the thing that's always kind of struck me and stuck in my head and why I absolutely love Irma Vep as a concept is the movie kind of ends with the director having a complete nervous breakdown and delivering a finished product of the film that is just like this destroyed piece of art that is completely unreleasable and uncomprehensible. And to this day, anytime I'm just like, I send out the first cut of a film that I've edited to a client, it used to be, it'd be like, oh God, I hope they like it. But now I'm at this point where I've just cut so many things where I'm just like, oh, is this the one where I had a complete nervous breakdown? And in my mind, I think I nailed it. But what I delivered is basically Irma Vep. And so the movie is like stuck in my head for quite a number of years, and I have a lot of affection for it, even though I have not seen it since the 90s. And I think the next Criterion flash sale, I'm going to pick up Irma Vep again. But then I saw new series with Alicia Vikander in the lead role. In this one, she is not playing herself. She's playing a character named Mira, but it's very kind of styled after Alicia Vikander in a lot of ways, or at least in an archetype of a actor in her kind of sort of like current day position. And the show goes a lot bigger than the movie did. Like, the show starts off, we're with her on a press junket for basically the latest Marvel movie sort of thing. And that's the world she's coming out of. And she's excited to be going to France to work on this film with an acclaimed director. And then we hang out with the director for a while, who's this guy who's has a very kind of spotted career where he's having to deal with the producers about insurance problems because he's uninsurable for his past bad boy behavior. But now he's on mood stabilizer, so everything should be okay. And he's not really describing to Alicia very well what he wants her to be doing. So she's, like, really confused and lost and trying to, like, figure out the character on her own and dealing with her own stuff. And there's another actor who just really wants to force his ex, who's also working on the movie, to have a sex scene with him that isn't in the movie. And so there's a whole scene where he's basically pitching to her the role of intimacy coordinators on films. And so it's dealing with a lot of kind of more like modern day topics that have been going around the film industry a lot in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. And it's doing so in a very kind of similar tone that the original film did. And honestly, so far, like one episode in, I think it's delightful. I'm really enjoying it. So I'm, you know, really interested to see where it goes in the long haul. And I'm kind of glad that they're able to, like, take the canvas a little bit larger, expand it out to a few more characters that are on the film production, and just sort of, like, play in those little melodramas that are occurring all around.
I'm curious to see this, but I think I might wait until there's a few more episodes before I dive in. But yeah, I'm sold.
I know. It feels so out of left field. It feels like of all the things you thought would get remade into a series, Irma Vep? No.
And I'll finish by just saying it's not movie related, but one of the reasons that I haven't been watching a lot of movies or a lot of TV in general is I've fallen into the deep, dark abyss that is Penelope Douglas, who is an American author who has a number of books. But I picked up her Devil's Night series, and this is what I have been obsessively reading for the last 2 weeks. I've gone through like 1,200 pages of Penelope Douglas. So it's kind of, she's built this little universe that feels very much like something out of the CW, but like on crack cocaine. They had a lot of crack on the CW, but holy shit, not this good stuff. Yeah, it's not for everybody, but man, I am knee deep. So,
I mean, as long as we're talking about reading, I have continued my obsession with the imprint Hard Case Crime, getting as many books as I can. And I think at this point I'm like at about 90 books in my collection. So it's gotten pretty big.
Yes, that's a lot of books.
I mean, I'm going to get them all eventually, but I've got like, I think 7 more that are on the way. I'm finding it in a fun little endeavor because I've basically, it's all along a very like specific genre that all these books are, but it's not the sort of situation where I have to, you know, once I've finished with the book, I have to decide, okay, let me find another book that I want to read to sort of like, what am I moving on to? Instead, I've decided to say, okay, everything that this imprint puts out, I'm game for. And so I am going to, whatever it is, I'm going to read it. And so I end up getting introduced to a lot of stuff that maybe I probably wouldn't have found otherwise if it weren't for the fact that I'm just like, I'm going to read everything in the Hard Case Crime series. And they're very easy reads for the most part. And there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there. I just found out today one of the graphic novels that I got is called Babylon Berlin. And apparently there was, or still is, a series based on it on Netflix from Tom Tykwer.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I didn't even know this. It has 3 seasons currently and is getting a 4th season. And I've got the graphic novel sitting right here that it's based on as part of the Hard Case Crime series that I haven't read yet. So I'm going to read that graphic novel and then I'm going to dive into that series. Because nice. I like Tom Tykwer as well.
You did? Oh, I wrote that one down, adding that to the list. Because, you know, I need more things to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. We all need more things to watch. And I guess other things on the periphery is I've been buying a lot of 4Ks lately for stuff. And the newest thing I just picked up, and it looks absolutely beautiful, is the new 4K for Lawrence of Arabia, which just came out. It's in a stunning little steel book. They have, for the 4K, they've split the movie with intermission between two discs to do it at the highest encoding quality possible. And it looks absolutely stunning. Yeah. I'd been waiting for Lawrence of Arabia to get released in 4K.
So this is the first 4K release for that movie?
I believe it is, yeah.
Wow. That might be worth picking up for sure. I haven't bought anything new other than records. I know my Dune soundtrack has shipped. It'll be here soon. Because, you know, I needed another Mondo vinyl. Why not?
Yeah, and I've pre-ordered the Everything Everywhere All at Once 4K. So as soon as that comes out, which I think is in like a week or two, it's going to arrive.
Yes, we need to watch that. Dan is really keen on seeing that. So we may try to find some time while we're out of town this weekend to watch a couple of things and get caught up. But anything else before we wrap things up?
I think that's it for me.
Me too. I will try to watch a few more things between now and the next time we talk. I do have a long laundry list. I mean, I've added a bunch of more things to my watch list this week. So, you know, maybe I'll catch up with some of them.
That's how it always works.
Always, every time. So come on by atcpod.ca for links to all the things we talked about today. Ashley, again, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Ashley Lynch. And I'll remind people that the new season of Ninjago, which I edited, is its current state kind of unknown because in the US they kind of dropped like the first 12 episodes on Netflix and then they pulled them off of there. So I don't know what's going on, but it's getting released in some form soonish. I don't know. Look around. I don't know quite what they're doing with the release schedule, but I know the whole thing's supposed to be out very soon.
Oh, wow. Okay. And you can find me at the Marina, and I have not edited anything that was cool like Ninjago. So,
well, you edit the show.
Yeah, sure. Which is cooler, but also much shorter. So until the next time.
Insert catchphrase here.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.